We are very privileged tonight to have Dr. Richard Howell with us. If you did not know, but there is a seminary in our area called the Southern Evangelical Seminary, and they were birthed out of Calvary Church on South Charlotte. How many years ago? In 1992. And it has grown and grown. They now have about 500 students that participate mostly online. And one of the gentlemen that was very early on in that seminary and doing apologetics is Dr. Richard Howell. And he lives in out north of Atlanta right now. And him and his wife, Rebecca, drove up here to be with us this weekend. So we need to give him a round of applause just for that. Just to escape Atlanta and come up 85 is treacherous in itself. All right, before I say anything else, I need to remind you teenagers, at 8:10, you're going to meet in the courtyard to go do your activity afterwards. 8:10 in the courtyard. All right, so let me get back to introducing Mr. Richard. He is the Norman L. Geiser Chair of Christian Apologetics at Southern Evangelical Seminary. That's that seminary that came out of Calvary. They started over in the Matthews area, and then they moved over off of 521, and now they're being based out of Rock Hill. So they're all around us, and one of the things that makes the seminary special is their emphasis on apologetics. So a lot of pastors, even though they got their degree, will sign up and take classes just so they can brush up on their apologetics. Did you know the word apologetics doesn't mean I'm sorry as it started out? It means to give an argument for or to give reason for. And so Dr. Richard has co-authored several books. He has produced material, curriculum called Into God's Revelation. And so he's very, has a lot of history behind him and a lot of experience doing apologetics. Not only that, but the seminary and he himself have gone to college campuses across the country and even over to Europe, overseas, doing apologetics and meeting college students and speaking into college students' lives. So all I'm trying to tell you, we're very privileged to have him here with us today. And so it is my prayer that you are blessed and that you will receive some tools to put in your tool belt for when people ask you what you believe and why you believe it, and they ask those questions about why you believe. And when you go off to college, teenagers, that you'll have the tools you need to defend your faith and stay strong in your faith. So I'm going to say a word of prayer, and I'm going to let Mr. Richard come and have the floor, and we're going to pray that God does a great work. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for today. I thank you that Dr. Richard's with us and that he came a long distance to come and bless us. Lord, may we be ready to receive with open hearts. May we be ready to take notes. May we be ready for when people ask us these very important questions. And Lord, may it even be an encouragement to us in our faith as well. Be with our time. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Am I on? Okay. All right. That's all for tonight. Thank you for coming. Well, just want to see if we could get the technology working. So I appreciate Pastor Wayne mentioning the issue of college students, because just really quickly, just to let you know and kind of set a context for some stuff I want to share with you tonight. Even though I was born and reared in the Bible Belt, you know, we're referred to as a Bible Belt in this part of the U.S. I was raised in Mississippi. Even though that, I wasn't raised in the church. Never went to church as a child. It was a great, stable family. My parents were loving, hardworking. But I didn't have any clue about my need for a Savior. I always believed in God as a child, but never understood my need for a Savior until I got 16 years old. God had been working with me for about 2 years. I got saved when I was 16 through friends of mine in school that were helping me understand what Jesus did for me, who he was, and his payment on the cross. I was a long-haired, rock drummer back in the 70s, okay? Just enough to annoy everyone around me, okay? I mean, I wasn't playing with anybody famous or anything. But, so I went off to school, went off to university, did music. I was a percussion major, but I decided I don't want to major in that fully because I didn't want to do that as a career. Made that my minor. Somebody told me you could go to college and study the Bible. It was the most amazing thing I ever heard in my life. I thought, I want to do that. My church didn't prepare me for what I might encounter when I was at university. So to make a short story long, I lost my faith. Now, I don't believe you can lose your eternal life, but you can lose a lot of things, including your confidence in the truth of the Scriptures. It was Christian apologetics that brought me back to the Lord in terms of the intellect, understanding now not just merely what I believe, but now begin to understand why do I believe what I believe. So, names you would probably find familiar, people like Josh McDowell or R.C. Sproul or Norman Geiser, who's a co-founder of our seminary, poured into my life either through their personal ministries as I was a student of Norm Geiser or through their cassette tape ministries. Cassette tapes are these little plastic things, in case you were wondering what that was. I saw somebody with a t-shirt on and it was a cassette tape on a walker. Said, I got to get one of those shirts. Okay, so let's start the presentation and you'll see why this matters to me. I want to see this first picture here. I don't know if anybody can get the joke. I would not expect anybody. In fact, I would be just amazed if anybody gets this joke. Any takers that want to take it? Okay, so I obviously photoshopped my name and the title of our talk and the seminary behind this august-looking gentleman. But he actually is Bertrand Russell, probably the, going go to the next slide there, his work that he did. He's probably one of the most revered philosophical atheists in Anglo-American philosophy in the 20th century. And his book, titled Why I'm Not a Christian, was probably up until Richard Dawkins wrote the book The God Delusion. You may or may not be familiar with that. But up until that book came out, I would venture to guess that Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian probably disabused more college students of their faith than any other single work. So to that end, I want to say a little bit about proofs about God's existence. The slides you're going to see here are a very small subset of a really long PowerPoint that I do in class, in some of the classes that I teach. But what I've done is I've made a PDF slide deck, basically, of the slides, of the entire presentation. I want to show you how you can get that. Several reasons why, because if a source I mention and you didn't, what book was that, what page was that on, you can get that out of the slide deck. And then you can see a lot of the things that we didn't have time to go into tonight in the full one there. And so here's how you can do it to it. So if you go to the website, now it won't look like this. Go ahead and go to the next slide there. It won't look like that likely in the next few days since this is going to be over this weekend. I'll change the front page. It's a pretty cheesy website. But if you'll look at the URL there, you go to richardghowe.com. Don't leave the G out. Okay? I can't guarantee you what you're going to get. And it's easy to remember because the G stands for good looking. Okay. And for some reason, Pastor Wayne, I don't know why people laugh when I say that. They're like, what is funny about that? There. But if you look at the arrow pointing on the right sidebar right there, on the, see the very white right there, that's a picture of the website of the church. You click on that, basically it'll take you to the PDF slide deck for this, all right? So I invite you to do that. Some time ago, in fact, I was only 10 years old when this Time magazine came out. Is God dead? In fact, I have it with me somewhere if you want to look at it a little bit later on. Now, obviously, the concept of could God die is ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense. By both sides, atheists or theists would say, well, if God did exist, he couldn't die. That wouldn't make any sense. But what the article was about, Time magazine would keep its finger on the pulse of what's going on in America very often. I don't know if it's still doing that, but it was it back in the 60s. And what the God is Dead movement was, as it came to be known, was this idea that, well, the concept of God really has lost its usefulness in society. The natural sciences now are really giving us all the answers we need to flourish. This is right after the Second World War, and America's really beginning to flourish in a lot of different ways. So we really don't need God anymore. So is he really just passé now, at least among the scholars? And so you see this cover in a lot of apologetics books where they bring this subject up, as I'm doing tonight. But what you don't see very often is another Time magazine cover that came out 3 years later in 69, is God coming back to life? Because they realize, wait a minute, some of the scholars go, ho, hang on. You know, rumors of God's demise have been greatly exaggerated. And there were these scholars that started to step forward, not only in the natural sciences, but also in the philosophical studies, to saying, hey, not so fast. There is a lot to be said academically about the question of God's existence. Now, occasionally, I'm going to strategically reach over and grab a cool cup of cold ice water. I do that just to make everybody in the audience thirsty, and I'm taking a sip in your own there. By the way, is this being recorded? Okay, so that awkward pause, if you're just listening to this, was me taking that strategic sip. That's what that was. Is it video or audio only? Okay, because see, if I had a bottled water, I would hold it up and do product placement, you know. So, what does the Bible say about the question of God's existence in terms of our coming to believe and the things of arguments and stuff? Psalm 19:1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. The idea that you can see somehow evidence of the existence and nature of God by the creation. Psalm 97 says, the heavens declare all righteousness, his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. My favorite verse in this context is out of Romans chapter 1, verse 20. It says, for since the creation of the world, now listen to how quirky this language is, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. How? Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and deity or Godhead. So somehow, from what we see here, taste, touch, or smell, we can argue and demonstrate, I'm going to try to prove to you tonight, that there is the God that we now identify as the God of the Bible. Now, why do we need to make these arguments? Well, when you think of something like the belief in God with respect to something like eternal life, we're not saying that merely believing in God's existence is enough to have eternal life, okay? But I think it's fair to say that you would at least need to believe in God's existence in order to be able to go on to believe the gospel. Hebrews 11:6 says, but without faith it's impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now, when it comes to this question of belief in God and the evidence, then I would submit several things. One, that there is that evidence. So since there is that evidence, then if we meet someone who's doubting the existence of God, it behooves us to try to marshal what some of that evidence might be. We might as well do that. It's very interesting. I teach the world religions class at the seminary as well. And I think it's fair to say that by and large, throughout the world's religions and throughout the world's philosophies, you find some modicum of a deity of sorts. Sort of like these faint echoes of what Adam and Eve knew to be true and told their children, or Noah and his wife and children told theirs later on, and that echo is still redounding through history. So, in other words, the belief in God is almost universal geographically all around the world and chronologically throughout all time. Now, that doesn't prove God exists, but I think it might be relevant in this respect. I think it might be a flag that God exists. Because sometimes when the atheist says, well, you know, if you say, well, everybody believes, so many people believe in the existence of God, and they go, well, there's all kinds of reasons why they may believe that, blah, 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 and so there is no God. If they're not careful, their argument would sound like if somebody was trying to deny the existence of water. And they say, well, you know, everybody's thirsty. Wouldn't the fact that if everybody was thirsty, that would be a hint that there actually is water? Not, oh, well, there's likely not to be real water because everybody's thirsty. I would think it would be the opposite. If there's some part of us that is lacking in some way, then it seems reasonable to at least explore the possibility that there's some aspect of reality that's commensurate with that lack. Now, when it comes to how the scholars catalog various arguments for God's existence, or if you prefer the word proof, or sometimes you might hear the word demonstration, they really fall into four major, maybe you could think of a few more, but perhaps these four would exhaust. And we're not going to do all of them, so I don't want you to worry about how long we're going to be here. We're going to go about 30 minutes with me, and then go about 30 minutes of Q&A. And usually when I get asked to do a Q&A, I suggest that we just do Q, because then you get a lot more questions in, and it just goes a lot smoother. But we'll do the A if there is an A to be given. So the first is a cosmological argument. It comes from the Greek word cosmos, translated universe in some respects, or the world. So these are arguments that somehow build on evidence from the existence and nature of the universe to the existence and nature of God. Then you have also design arguments. Design arguments are intended not so much on the existence of the universe, but certain characteristics that the universe has that seem to bespeak of some kind of intelligent cause. Then you're more technical, you would have what are called teleological arguments. It comes from the Greek word telos, which means end or goal. The Latin for that is finis, where we get the English word finish. So the finish line is the end or goal of a race, right? So the teleology is this idea that many things in this world, particularly living things, have a goal-directedness to their life, a trajectory that they're on. The tadpole will always only become a bullfrog. It's not going to get on an exit ramp and become a sperm whale, right? An acorn is always only going to become an oak tree. And so this idea of goal-directedness of living things in the teleological argument is parlayed into an argument showing that that ultimately bespeaks of an intelligent cause. And then the last is the moral argument. Probably the moral argument gets more traction because while some people may or may not be interested in cosmology or teleology or all this kind of stuff, I don't know anybody that isn't impacted by moral reality. Dr. Geisler used to tell us, you can tell a lot more about someone's ethics not by how they act, but how they react. You know, because then you really start to see, oh, you really do believe there's objective right and wrong. If the teacher just decides to arbitrarily give you an F because he didn't like the ink color that you use, that's not fair. You know, that kind of stuff. So that can be, I think, put in together in such a way that gives an argument for God's existence. So I want to focus now just on some of the scientific evidence that point to the fact that there is a God and that he has certain characteristics. First of all, there are some strengths I want to point out about these types of arguments. In my experience, the scientific arguments generally avoid trafficking in the technicalities of academic philosophy. Oh, sorry. If you've ever had a philosophy class, perhaps, which are far less familiar than the basic categories of the natural sciences. Now, I can throw rocks at philosophy because both my master's degree from Ole Miss, oh, sorry, and then from University of Arkansas, sorry, at least I stayed in the SEC, that's what I tell people, okay. But both my master's degree and PhD are in philosophy, so that's really near and dear to my heart. But scientific arguments benefit also from the clout that it has in culture. You know, in the Middle Ages, the worst thing that could be said about someone is that they were a heathen and they were out of graces from the church. Today, the worst thing you can say about somebody is to say that they're unscientific, right? Because the sciences now have come front and center in our culture. But there are some weaknesses, too, to these kinds of issues and making these arguments. I would submit, without much fanfare tonight, that without further bolstering in arguments, scientific arguments don't demonstrate that the cause of the universe is the God of the Bible necessarily. It doesn't pick that God out specifically. And for that matter, it wouldn't necessarily show that he still exists even after he created. A lot of things that I think the scientific arguments in isolation would fail. But for the most part, I think they carry a lot of weight and can have a lot of this clout in people's minds. But more narrowly then are my weaknesses, because some of the aspects of the science are disputed. I try to temper my quotes and characterizations by many scientists say, or some scientists say, rather than all scientists say, because I realize that some of these things are controversial, maybe too strong a term, but at least disputed to some extent. And because they're disputed, these kind of disputes get technical and are beyond the knowledge of the non-scientists like me. I'm not a scientist. So if there's a scientist here tonight that wants to take issue with one of the scientists that I brought up, that's fair, but I can't referee that debate. All I can say is, well, here's some sources that I've read, And I'll read some sources that you've written or read, and we'll go from there. So knowing my limitations in the natural sciences, maybe that'll forestall a lot of potential questions that come up. The philosophy I'm a little bit more comfortable with, even though that's disputed too, but I'm more used to those kind of disputes. So let me give you an argument. If you've not heard, then you've probably been living under a rock sometime in the past 20 years, because it's just everywhere on the internet. And the argument basically is this. First premise, the universe began to exist. Second, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Conclusion, therefore the universe has a cause. So what the argument tries to do is say, if you can show the scientific evidence that the universe began a finite time ago, then that's on the way of showing then whatever caused that universe is something outside the universe and is sufficiently different from the universe that it starts sounding pretty closely to what most people mean when they say God. So what is some of this evidence for the fact that there was a beginning of the universe? So scientific evidence for the beginning. There are three, only one of which will I spend some time on here for the sake of time. And that is the Big Bang Theory, the expanding universe, and the second law of thermodynamics. I want to just say a few things about the Big Bang Theory, but let me define all three for our purposes. The Big Bang Theory, the definition is, scientists maintain that the universe began in a colossal explosion a finite time ago. The universe could not have existed from eternity. Otherwise, it wouldn't be the case that the scientists have shown that it began a finite time ago. Therefore, the universe began to exist. That's what the argument will try to show with the Big Bang Theory. Now, I'll come back to that in a minute, unpack a little bit more. The expanding universe, basically what this says is, scientists maintain that every object in the universe is moving away from every other object. I'm moving away from my laptop. Hold on. Okay, I got to get back to it. Such that even space is itself expanding. I don't understand that a lot, but they characterize it by examples like polka dots on a balloon, and as you blow the balloon up, the dots get farther apart. It doesn't mean that I'm moving away from my glasses. It means in terms of the big galaxies and things, they're all moving away. Because if space is expanding, one of the problems I have is how come I always have trouble on I-85? Could you expand a couple of more lanes here while we're getting... So the significance of expanding universe is that the universe could not have been expanding from eternity, otherwise it would be infinitely dispersed, which from all we've seen, it's not. Therefore, the universe began to exist a finite time ago. And then the second law of thermodynamics says, all isolated systems will tend towards a state of maximum disorder. All this means is any system into which energy is not being put, like your cell phone when it's removed from the charger, will eventually run down. In an isolated system, the amount of energy available to do work decreases and becomes uniform. This amounts to saying that the universe is running down. And the universe could not have been running down from eternity, otherwise it would have been run down by now, which is not. Therefore, the universe began to exist a finite time ago. That's all these arguments that can be leveled scientifically about that first premise. So let's go back to the Big Bang Theory. The first question, though, that comes to many people's minds, well, can a young Earth creationist use the Big Bang Theory in an argument for God's existence? Seems like there's a lot of baggage there. Now, I'm a young Earth creationist. I've got dear friends who love God, who love His Word, that are old Earth creationists. I think they're wrong, but I think that I'm convinced that they love the Bible and they love its inerrancy, that a lot of times this stuff about Genesis, is it day age, is there a gap, are exegetical disputes that, again, I can't referee. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I leave that up to my brother, who is a Hebrew scholar. Let him talk about these. But I do think there is a sense in which, that a young Earth creationist, when people ask me sometimes, how old do I think the universe is, I say, I'm not certain, but I think it's pretty close to 70. Pretty confident about that. Although I have to admit, I've got the first few years on hearsay, but I'm pretty confident it's at least that old. Paul Davis, who's an astrophysicist at the University of Arizona, he says this, these days, most cosmologists and astronomers back the theory that there was indeed a creation. When the physical universe burst into existence in an awesome explosion popularly known as the Big Bang, whether one accepts all the details or not, emphasize that, the essential hypothesis that there was some sort of creation seems from the scientific point of view compelling. So that's my caveat going, okay, well, I don't know about some of the other baggage that people say come along with a Big Bang Theory cosmogony that I wouldn't be comfortable with as a young Earth creationist, but I don't really care about that. I'm just taking the central hypothesis. Steven Weinberg says, in the beginning, there was an explosion. Not an explosion like those familiar on Earth, but an explosion which occurred simultaneously everywhere, filling all space from the beginning. Stephen Hawking says, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Robert Jastrow, the founder of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies at Dartmouth, said, recent discoveries in astronomy have implications that may go beyond their contribution to science itself. In a nutshell, I like the guy that said, if you can get this in your head, you'll have it in a nutshell. It's like, wait a minute, what? Is that a compliment? It sounds like an insult. In a nutshell, astronomers studying the universe through their telescopes have been forced to the conclusion that the world began suddenly in a moment of creation as the product of unknown forces. Now, he says unknown forces. He personally is an agnostic. In fact, his book, God and the Astronomers, if you can chase this down, last time I checked, it were hard copies, pennies on the dollar. But it's worth, this book is quoted in almost every apologetics book that I'm familiar with, because how the book ends, and what basically what the book was about, was his summation of the evidence seems to be pointing more and more as we study the universe that it had a beginning and there's some kind of thing beyond the universe that made it. That's what the scientific evidence seems to be saying. The book was also observing how uneasy that made his fellow non-theistic scientists. He was an agnostic. Some of his fellow astronomers that were agnostic or atheist, but he's like, why does that bother you so much? If that's what the evidence says, then do it. In fact, here's what's quoted most often in these apologetic books is the very last paragraph of the book. He says, for the scientist who has lived his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries, going, what took you guys so long to finally do this whole end run back to theism that your science confirmed? So the evidence of the Big Bang Theory shows that the universe could not have always existed. Therefore, the universe began to exist a finite time ago. The evidence, which we didn't look at for the sake of time, for the expansion of the universe shows the universe cannot have been expanding from eternity. Therefore, the universe began to exist a finite time ago. And then the evidence of the second law of thermodynamics shows that the universe could not have been running down from eternity. Therefore, the universe began to exist a finite time ago. We're still just on that first premise. So when you have Big Bang Theory, expanding universe, second law of thermodynamics, all pointing to that one premise, the universe began to exist. So now what about the second premise? Whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. This one's a little easier to make to scientists, because the last thing that a scientist wants to abandon is the law of causality. Because if causality is thrown out, then you've thrown out all the sciences. Now, the philosophers, not so much. There you run into some skepticism there. But since I'm given the scientific evidence, then we don't have to worry about any of the philosophical stuff unless someone asks during the Q&A and such. So I think we're pretty comfortable when we're staying in the arena of the natural sciences that causality is going to be conceded pretty much by everybody, and they'll have to figure out some other way to weasel around what the conclusion is forcing them to. Otherwise, the conclusion says, therefore, the universe has a cause of its existence. Now, at this point, we haven't said anything about whether it's personal, whether it even still exists. Maybe it caused the universe and then stopped. Maybe there's more than one. We haven't proven there's only one God. None of those kind of things that matter to us as Christians that we want people to come to understand, they're a little downstream from this argument in its simple form. So let's look a little bit more at God as the cause of the design of the universe. What is some scientific evidence for design? Well, one is the idea of the fine-tuning. And I hear a lot of people misstate what this argument is. So if you've ever heard it, it's not the fine-tuning of the universe. That's what I hear a lot of Christians say. Hey, you know, the scientists have proved the fine-tuning of the universe. It's not the fine-tuning of the universe. It's the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. That's how the scientists would describe it. Because if you just say the fine-tuning of the universe, somebody go, well, how fine-tuned is my back right now after I, you know, and it seemed very fine-tuned to me. You've almost lost the argument, no matter how persuasive you are intellectually. That back's going to talk a lot louder than any argument that you give. You go, no, it's not. Because we can explain why the bat goes out in a finely tuned universe by the fall. But of course, that's already something downstream from the fact that we're trying to establish God's existence, so we can't prove everything at once. So design as fine-tuning of the universe. The definition of this fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe, as I correct myself. Scientists recognize the universe's initial condition contained in an array of physical values, what they call constants, that are necessary for the universe to support life. So we're not pulling the trigger on how this happened, whether it was a short period of time ago or a long period of time ago, whether it was through some kind of process or not. That's all fine to dispute, but that's just downstream. It's just what it is as far as the argument is going. So it would seem then that the likelihood of these values being what they are could come by chance is impossible, practically impossible. It would be like walking into a room and there was a stereo system and it had like a billion knobs, and each knob had to be in exactly the right spot for that stereo system to be playing your favorite song. And you say, what are the odds of that? Well, it's actually even more than just a billion knobs. So therefore, the status of the universe to support life seems to have been designed deliberately by an intelligent cause. Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow is the last book that Stephen Hawking wrote. And as far as I know, Hawking never did come to believe in the existence of God. I don't know if he did. I never heard about it, and that's possible. But he says this: the emergence of the complex structures capable of supporting intelligent observers seems to be very fragile. The laws of nature form a system that is extremely fine-tuned, and very little in physical law could have been altered without destroying the possibility of the development of life as we know it. Were it not for a series of startling coincidences. It's a startling coincidence for them. That's all they can do with it. In the precise details of physical law, it seems humans and similar life forms could never have come into being. But I want to see how likely a startling coincidence even could explain something as impossible as what we're talking about. When Robin Collins says, when scientists talk about the fine-tuning of the universe, he means fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe, they're generally referring to extraordinary balancing of the fundamental laws and parameters of physics and the initial conditions of the universe. Our minds can't comprehend the precision of some of them. The result is a universe that has just the right conditions to sustain life anywhere, not just Earth, but anywhere. The coincidences are simply too amazing to have been the result of happenstance. In fact, the next slide has a list of 35 of those parameters that have to be set up. Now, there may be one or two that I could tell you what that meant, all right? And then you can read the source there cited at the bottom. But the point to draw away from this is that an estimate, if you said, well, look, maybe there are a whole bunch of planets, and maybe that if there are a lot of planets, the odds are eventually it's going to develop some biological life. With a generous estimate of 10 to the 22nd power planets, that would be one with 22 zeros after it. That, if there were that many planets in the universe, the odds, given what we know about the laws of physics, of one life-supporting planet is 1 in 10 to the 138th power. Now, if you're like me, that number doesn't mean anything to me. 10 to the 22nd power probably doesn't mean. So how big is the number 10 to the 138th power? Well, just to kind of give you a ratio here, sort of a relative number, the number of atoms in the known universe is estimated to be about 10 to the 79th power. So if you took an atom and painted an X on it, which right there, that's hard enough just to do that part. But if you could do that and throw that atom out into the entire universe and stir it all up, the odds that you could pick that one atom out of the entire universe is 1 in 10 to the 79th power. That's how big. By the way, if you want to know how they get that number, you can get the PDF deck and get this slide and go to that YouTube, and this scientist there shows you how they come to that estimate. But let me give you an illustration that I heard. If you take a deck of cards, there are 52 cards in a deck. How many possibilities are there in terms of the order in which those cards could be put? 52 cards. That equation in math is called 52 factorial. And it would be basically 52 times 51 times 50 times 49, and you calculate that number out. Now, how big is that number, 52 factorial? Just let me tell you, 52 factorial is smaller than the 10 to the 79th power, which is smaller than the 10 to the 138. So we're talking about a smaller number than that. Here's how big that number is to give you. This is what helped me. Imagine you're on the planet Earth. Okay, we are on the planet. I have to imagine that. But you never know who's streaming Facebook these days, you know, just covering my bases. So you're on the planet, and you've got a stopwatch, and you're going to time 52 factorial seconds. So you get it clicking, all right? So it's counting seconds, 52 factorial. Here's what you do. You take a step, and then you wait a billion years. And then you take a step, and then you wait a billion years. And then you take a step and wait a billion years. And you keep taking steps with a billion years between each step until you go all the way around the world. When you get all the way around the world, then you take one drop of water out of the Pacific Ocean. And then you do it again. Step, billion years, a step, a billion. And you do that again and take a second drop of water out of the Pacific Ocean. And then you go all the way around and then you take a second. And you keep doing that until you've emptied the entire Pacific Ocean. When you've emptied the entire Pacific Ocean, then you take a piece of paper and set it on the ground. And then you start the process again. Fill the Pacific Ocean back up, a step, a billion years, a step, a billion years. And you go around and another drop, until you've emptied the Pacific Ocean again, put a second piece of paper on the ground. And you do that process, and you keep doing that, another piece of paper on the ground. When your stack of paper has reached the sun, you are about two-thirds of the way through 52 factorial seconds in that much time. So what the scientists are saying is when you calculate the mathematical odds, in fact, there's a great YouTube panel discussion on the mathematical challenge to evolution, not to get into Dr. Potter's talk tomorrow night, but the mathematicians are just going, this is nuts. The biologists, they deal in narratives and stories. The mathematicians deal in concrete numbers, and the mathematicians are not at all, at least the ones I've talked to, are not at all comfortable with the idea that the evolution could even occur. But I'll leave that to Dr. Potter to depend. So Paul Davis again says, it's hard to resist the impression that the present structure of the universe, so apparently sensitive to minor alterations in the numbers, has been rather carefully thought out. The seemingly miraculous concurrence of these numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants must remain the most compelling evidence of cosmic design. And one other scientist here, John Polkinghorne, whose terminal degree not only in theology but also in, I think, physics. I think he's an Anglican priest, and then he's a high-energy physicist or something. Says there seems to be a chance of a revised and a revived argument from design, appealing to a cosmic planner who has endowed the world with a potentiality implanted within the delicate balance of the laws of nature themselves, which law science cannot explain because it assumes them as the basis for its explanation of the process. In short, the claim would be that the universe is indeed the carefully calculated construct of its creator. Now, how much time do I have? You been keeping watch? 25 minutes? Have you been? Because I forgot to look at mine. All right. Then we'll just skip Dr. Potter and just I'll just stay all night and all tomorrow night. I'm winding it down because I do want to take the questions, and if we do skip the answers, then we will have plenty of time. So now let me look at one other thing, because this is kind of gives us this idea of this cause being personal. And that's the idea of design as information. So information, also known as specified complexity, is physically distinguishable from simple complexity on the one hand and then simple order on the other. And the presence of information always points to an intelligent cause. For example, the Blythe River Canyon in South Africa. Rebecca and I have the privilege of going to South Africa every year. It's four movies and an eight-hour sleep, and you're there, okay, if you ever want to pop down to Johannesburg or Pretoria. So you look at this canyon landscape, and there's a lot of complexity there in terms of textures and colors and the arrangements and things, and you can explain all that complexity, and perhaps even to a certain degree the arrangement, by known laws of physics and biology and such. There's nothing really, I mean, it might be difficult to do, but it all falls comfortably within the boundaries of the natural science. Suppose you were climbing that mountain, you came on the snowflake. Now, the snowflake is incredibly ordered. It's not particularly complex, but it's very, very ordered, hexagonal angles of the snowflake itself. It's easily explained by the nature of the hydrogen bond in a water molecule. So they're shaped like little L's, and as they're floating around as a liquid, when it freezes, they come out like that, and they form this this particular degree angle, and they freeze, and it makes water unique among liquids on Earth that it expands when it freezes. It's the only liquid that does that. If it didn't, then marine life would die at the first freeze if it froze from the bottom up. But ice will float, which means it will freeze in a lake, and then underneath it'll still be liquid. Marine life can survive. So you can explain the technicalities, I'm sorry, the complexity of the landscape. You can explain the order of the snowflake. But suppose you go around and you see this on a mountain. You see Mount Rushmore. Well, now, what's going on here? Well, it has a certain complexity in a way. It has a certain order, but there's something else going on. It's a certain specificity to the order. It's information that is being conveyed. And if you stumbled on this, you would never feel obligated that you had to explain these phases by strategic array of wind and water erosion, for example, over the course of millions of years that carved out these four faces on the top of this mountain. By the way, if you've ever gone around the backside of Mount Rushmore, that's the way. A lot of people don't go there, but that's what it looks like from the other side. There. So, anyway. So, the point is that information then, conveys intelligence. Well, where do we find this kind of information in nature? In their book, The Mystery of Life's Origins, Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson say proponents of an intelligent origin of life note that molecular biology has uncovered an analogy between the DNA in living systems and language. The genetic code functions exactly like a language code. Indeed, it is a code. It's a molecular communication system. A sequence of chemical letters stores and transmits the communication in each living cell. In fact, since they wrote this, we had Charles Thaxton, when I was a student at Ole Miss, in the 19 debate on creation evolution. And even that long ago was pretty advanced. Today, it's amazing what Origin of Life studies done. So even the atheist scientist Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, acknowledges there's enough information capacity in a single human cell to store the Encyclopedia Britannica, all 30 volumes of it, three or four times over. There's how much information you could put in the molecular size of a cell. So Stephen Meyer, who's a historian of philosophy of science and probably one of the leading voices in this conversation today, in his book, Signature of the Cell, says that nearly the same time that computer scientists were beginning to develop machine languages, molecular biologists were discovering that living cells have been using something akin to a machine code or software all along. So in addition to his Signature of the Cell, he followed that up with Darwin's Doubt, and then his most recent book is called Return of the God Hypothesis. He heads up an organization out of Washington State called it's a speech therapy organization. That's what I need right now. It's called the Discovery Institute. It's a think tank of scientists. Not all of them are necessarily Christian, but they're all working in this intelligent design field and stuff. So I love the conclusion you can draw where the scientist says, if I can create life here in the laboratory, I will have proven it didn't take an intelligence to create life in the beginning. It's like, well, you just proved. I debated an atheist once at the University of Arkansas, and I made this point about information and design in this respect, and he actually said to the audience, well, I wrote a computer program that ordered the computer to randomly pick out pixels and color them. He said, you let it run long enough, it starts forming patterns. Like, you wrote the computer program. I mean, you're making my point. Your computer wouldn't have done that if you hadn't have programmed it to do that and stuff. So what can we conclude then? The Bible testifies that the creation gives evidence of the Creator. Many, if not most scientists today, acknowledge that the universe began a finite time, and therefore one can argue that it must have had a cause. Many scientists recognize that the initial conditions of the universe had to be what they are for there to be any biological life anywhere in the universe, yet it is so inconceivably improbable that this could have occurred by chance that it could only be accounted for by intelligent design. And scientists acknowledge that the DNA of living systems contains information, but in every other occasion, the presence of information indicates an intelligence. To summarize that then, since it is the cause of the universe, what can we say about this cause? Since it's the cause of the material universe, then it cannot itself be material. It's because it's the cause of materiality. Since it is the cause of the spatial universe, it cannot itself be spatial. Since it's the cause of the temporal universe, it cannot itself be temporal. And since it is the cause of information, it must be an intelligence, which is to say it's personal. Thus, we have, if you will, a timeless, spaceless, immaterial, intelligent cause of the universe of unimaginable power. I mean, if it quacks and has feathers and a web feet and a bill. So as Thomas Aquinas said, all men know this to be God. Questions?
So we're going to use the microphone so people at home can hear, and then our recording. We're going to put this on Facebook and our website so people can refer to it at later times. So if you have a question, raise your hand. I'll bring you a microphone.
All right, let's go home. All
right.
All right, Jerry, be nice now.
Well, I will say that you talk a lot smarter up there than you do around the dinner table.
It's because my mouth was full sometimes.
Yeah. Do you ever broach the area of geology or you know, dinosaur paleontology, any of that?
Do you mean do I broach it in the context of arguments for God's existence or just more broadly?
Yes.
No, I never have done that. I did have the privilege of doing a 7-day whitewater rafting trip down the Colorado River through the, I don't even swim. Well, Rebecca had to talk me into taking this opportunity. Put on by a young earth creationist ministry, Answers in Genesis. And it was, and all of us that were going were all academics and seminary professors and such. And we had lectures all day long in hikes and stuff on geology and creationism. And it was absolutely astounding. So a source that I would recommend is a gentleman named Andrew Snelling. And Snelling took Henry Morrison and John Wickham's The Genesis Flood. Some of you older people here may have remembered that book that came out in the 60s or 70s, whatever it was. And he revamped that. He's a geologist. It's now a 2-volume set called Earth's Catastrophic Past. So I'll let Andrew Snelling and Ken Wolgamuth, who's an old earth creationist geologist, I'll let those titans battle it out. I've not ventured into that area much, but I did have the privilege to hear Andrew, though, once, or several times, actually.
Hello.
Hello.
If you don't mind, I've got a follow-up question, too.
Please.
Let's make it formal. One of the things that kind of living this environment every day and thinking outside of the academic classroom, how difficult or easy have you found people to understand these philosophies and this rationale?
So that's an easy question for me to answer as a philosopher in this respect. What I think matters so much in terms of philosophical categories and data points and stuff, used to be and used to undergird what we identify as Western civilization. Since about the 18th century, it began to wane in Western civilization, so that now even the categories and such are starkly unfamiliar to people. And those are the ones that I would appeal to try to parlay a good philosophical argument for the existence of God, for example. But you never get to the arguments because it would take so long in most instances to just catch somebody up to go, well, this is what act and potency is in Aristotle, and this is what his 10 categories are, and this is what, essence, existence, distinction, and teleology. You get all those things in. Now, what I do in my class on classical philosophy, just to help the students get there quickly in a semester, is I have a thought experiment at the beginning. You can get this off the website. RichardGHow.com. You just click on resources and then PDF slide decks. And it's a thought experiment of Aristotle out camping with his dog. And what I try to argue there is just the normal things that people see, hear, taste, touch, or smell that I think most people would recognize point to these basic categories in classical philosophy, out of which then the classical arguments for God's existence are made. But it's tough. I mean, that's why Pastor Wayne had the wisdom not to ask me, hey, would you give some philosophical proofs for the existence of God? Not unless you want everybody to run and hide the children, you know, or take a nap or something. Not because you're not smart enough to do it. It's just that the categories are so unfamiliar. You're just as smart as anybody else to get this stuff. It's just that it's so unfamiliar, one would have to just kind of chew on it and processing, I'm not really sure what teleology is or essence, existence, or the 10 categories of Aristotle, or act and potency, or form and matter, or Aristotle's four causes, or Aquinas is this. So it's tough. Now, the science, though, is a lot more, but I'm at a disadvantage because I'm not a scientist, so I can kind of throw this stuff out, some good resources, and then if somebody is a biologist or something, I'd say you have to take it up with a real scientist. I'll just tell you what some of their conclusions are. Hope that answered your question. Probably more than you wanted to know, maybe. Rebecca and I are thinking about starting a podcast called More Than You Want. I just tell people, like, how's it going? And 15 minutes later, they go, you know, fine would have been a good answer. You could have just said fine. I would have been happy with that.
So again, yep. Living in this realm every day, what is the number one question that you get, and what is your response to that question?
You mean, again, with respect to the question of God's existence?
Yes.
I think undoubtedly the main question is going to have something to do with what Dr. Mauser is going to talk about Sunday night, which is if God is all-powerful and all-loving and all-good and all these things, then why is there such evil? Now, my version of that is if God is all-powerful and all-loving and all-good, why do people go bald? That's the question. If you can explain that one to me. But yeah, I think that's the one, undoubtedly. Because when people have they see a loved one suffering, a child with incurable cancer, and they just go, where is God? In fact, one of our faculty member who's now with the Lord was a conservative Jew, was saved as a senior football player for UCLA, played in the Rose Bowl, and found the Lord as a conservative Jew. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on the Holocaust called Where Was God? You can check that out by Barry Leventhal, because he tackles that right on, and he's got sort of a vested interest, as we say, a dog in the hunt, because he's Jewish and it happened to them, and where you have the hardest time explaining it. You're the chosen people. Why would God let that happen to you?
All right. As an Ole Miss fan and you mentioning that, I just have to say hottie totty. So there's that. But
All right, man, I feel good now.
But 2 years ago, I actually took our students through R.C. Sproul's book, Defending Your Faith, an Introduction into Apologetics.
I loved R.C.
And so if you wouldn't mind, you brushed over it and hinted at it all throughout, but I'm just going to give you a chance to stick on this a little bit more. He makes the point of the uncaused cause. And how that is necessary to understand this argument of creation and whether God exists. Would you mind diving into that?
So he's playing off a concept out of Aristotle, of Aristotle's unmoved mover. Unfortunate English translation of the Greek, because really what a better way to say it is the unchanged changer. Movement is just a word for a chain. Why do things change? And so where it really finds its zenith, I'll give you what's the elevator version of this, is in Thomas Aquinas. And it basically boils down to this, as much sense as this may or may not make. Aquinas argues that we can all observe that there's a difference between what a thing is, its essence, it's a dog, it's a tree, it's a human. We're talking about natural objects, not artificial things like laptops. You know, there's a difference, we can recognize the distinction between what something is and then that it exists. Right? In other words, we can think of things and we can know what they are that maybe don't even exist anymore. Or we can think of things like, say, an extinct animal, a dodo bird, for example. Or we can think of things and we know what they are that have never existed, like a hobbit. We all know what a hobbit is, but we all know that they don't exist. So the whatness of the hobbit and the existence or lack thereof are distinct. And we could just compound that with all kinds of examples. So Aquinas takes that distinction between what a thing is and that it exists and builds an argument to show that that nothing in that we experience in the world is responsible for its own existence. Nothing can cause itself to exist, right? So if it's existing right now, and for him, by the way, let me interrupt just a second, existence is not just the coming into existence. It's the actual existing. It's like a present tense. Existence is something happening, right? So if anything is existing, but nothing can explain this existing because of what it is. I don't have existence because I'm human, because lots of humans don't exist, like Sherlock Holmes. He's never had existence, but he's human. We understand that conceptually. So there's got to be some explanation. Then how is it that things that have existence but don't have it because of what they are? And Aquinas would argue because there has to be something whose very essence is existence itself. Its very nature is to be what the theologians call supreme being, or known in theology as aseity. So there's got to be something who is existing by what it is and not existing because something is giving it to it to what it is. So that essence existence distinction, I think, is, and that's what Sproul is getting at in terms of his acquaintance with not only Aristotle but with the Thomas Aquinas. That, and so, see, look, atheism is not just wrong from this classical perspective. It's not that it's wrong. It's absolutely incoherent, because to say God doesn't exist is just to say there is no existing. We're going, no, there's something is existing because it just is infinite existence itself. And he causes creation to exist. And, by the way, this is where it starts getting, the lines between philosophy and church get pretty blurred. Because you begin to realize, well, then it's not that God brought the universe into existence, like I argue tonight. He's continually causing it to sustain in existence, like a violinist playing a concerto. And if he stops or she stops, the music's just gone. It's like the creation is this symphony that the Lord is playing. I'm not just saying this, Pastor, because we're in church. But I can remember as a philosophy student, I used to do a lot of walking at night. That's where I had my quiet time. Rest of the day was my loud time, but this was my quiet time. And I remember right where I was in Tupelo, Mississippi, walking down Hood Avenue in Tupelo, when I finally grasped what it meant to say that God was the continual cause of my very being. At every instance, he's causing me to be. Because I had been taught, rightfully, as a teenage Christian, by the youth leadership, hey, you need to learn how to be a good steward of your time. Exactly. You need to be a good steward of your money and your talents. But I was confronted with, am I being a good steward of my very being? The very fact that I'm existing right now. What am I doing with what God has given me right now just to be? And man, it just put Jesus bumps all over. Those are the goosebumps you get when you talk about Jesus. And I also, all of a sudden, Pastor, found myself having a worship service by myself at about 11:30 at night when I was supposed to be. And I'm glad I wasn't merely doing philosophy, because it just morphed into some solid, I think, solid theology. Again, another installment of more.
Anybody else? Let's go.
Johnny,
to
now you got to be nice too.
Teenager.
Yes, sir. I've thought of this a lot, but there's like the fact of like innate behavior or innate like knowledge from a newborn organism point to the existence of the God. Like, for example, like, when a puppy is born, they don't open their eyes for the first like 2 weeks, but they know how to use its senses to find the mother to get nutrients.
Right.
So does that point to like a creator?
Absolutely, it does. In this respect, because it points to the fact that that puppy, to use your example, has certain faculties, what sometimes philosophers call operations, that are inherent to it because of the nature that it has. It has a dog nature. And its nature is what causes it to have the functions that it has. Well, the idea of nature, that's actually a philosophical category that you can parlay into a further argument for God's existence. And by the way, I think that's what, in my experience, what bogs down the abortion debate in our country. Two things. One, we don't have the luxury of time to wait till every American gets saved, and then now let's talk about abortion, or now let's talk about human trafficking or something. There's got to be some way to make these arguments that it doesn't matter whether they believe in God or not. We can still show you this is wrong. But here's what I think bogs down. It's because a lot of people today have this, what I would call a functional definition of what a human being is. So if you ask someone, say, what is a spoon? Well, it's just this thing that spoons. I mean, it's just a piece of material that spoons. I mean, if you take a spoon and cut the bowl off, it's not a spoon, it's a stick, right? So it wouldn't make sense if somebody walked into your house one and you're eating breakfast, they said you're eating your cereal with a false spoon. First thing you say is, what are you doing in my house at breakfast? Okay, get out of here. I hadn't finished my honey. But the second thing, I don't think you would disagree. You say, who are you to say this is a false spoon? My great-grandmother had this spoon, and she had other, my grandmother, and now they're giving it to you. How can you tell me it's a false? I think they wouldn't understand what you meant. So I don't know what a false spoon is. Why? Because a spoon just is what it does. It just spoons. People have that view of humans. They think humans are defined functionally. So you've got a pro-lifer and a pro-abortionist at the edge of a mine. They're looking down in the clay and stuff, and we say, hey, there's a spoon down there. What? You're talking about right there. There's that glint, that's a spoon. It wouldn't make any sense. That's not a spoon. That's just a fleck of metal. It's not a spoon until it gets enough metal together, and then it can function away, and then it's a spoon. So when we come to the debate and go, and we point to the zygote and go, that's a human, they just don't even understand what that. That's like saying that fleck of metal is a spoon. We've got to get them to understand, however difficult it is, that it's because they have a nature. They're human as soon as they come into existence. Not because, in other words, they have the functions eventually because of what they are, not the other way around, like a spoon would be. And it goes back to the question you're asking about these, and you see it in animals. They display the fact that they have natures as well. And that's a philosophical topic.
I almost forgot what I wanted to ask.
John, you got to be nice.
No, I just wanted to ask.
I'll just make something up.
Pardon me. No, I just wanted to ask the Big Bang Theory that's out there. It becomes a pretty good conversation with those non-believers or people that still are a little bit quiet about the conversation of God. Is it fair to say, look at it this way, God created the galaxy. In that galaxy is Earth. And he decided one's going to bump into Earth and do some magic things with
Absolutely.
It. In other words, get away from the Big Bang Theory being something that is complicated to try to solve in your brain, because nobody can.
It just boils right down.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, so life's not complicated. Man just complicates it with that whole theory, I think. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, it becomes relevant. By the way, let me interrupt myself. You realize this, so only about 100 years ago, the 1920s, all scientists believed that the universe was eternal. That was the reigning scientific view. In fact, even though the beginnings of a universe had a beginning thinking in the 20s, it really didn't get locked in until about the 1960s. Now all the scientists pretty much think there's a beginning, and now they're just squabbling over the details and such. So, I mean, it can something that if someone needs it and you want to make an argument like we tried to make tonight about the beginning of the universe, hey, if it began, they all say it did, a finite time ago, then something must have caused it. I think a lot of people go, that sounds like God to me. If they need a little bit more, then we give them a little bit more.
Right. I'll finish with question/statement to help wrap things up. Is it true that...
No, it's not. It's science. So let's put an end to it right now. I'm sorry.
That scientists, as in general, are moving more towards grand design, even as in scholarly
astounding.
Thought.
It is astounding. And I want to encourage, I don't know how many of you are young earth creationists like I am or not, but my experience with young earth creationists, it has nothing to do with Flint Hill Church. I'm just telling you my experience. Is they have such an allergy to a lot of these scientific arguments, precisely because some of them are also arguments that people may take a different direction into evolution. So this is what Dr. Potter is going to talk about tomorrow night. Don't be afraid of that stuff. I mean, take what we can that serves our purposes in the argument, and they are moving. The Discovery Institute is a great, great example of that. So check them out on the web.
So all the scientific community is moving towards grand design and the fact that there is a designer, but they would rather assign that design to aliens before they would assign it to God. Do you find that true?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So they're basically kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
And we all know, and though we'd be careful how we'd say this to our atheist friend, what's really at stake is their relationship with God, and that's what's bothering a lot of people, I think. And there's this this kind of skepticism that they're, and that's not all of them, but a lot of them in my experience, the skepticism that they bring up with all these objections are just to kind of a salve over what's really eating at them, and that's how they stand before their maker. And so that's what we want to get them to see, is this God is more than just a God who created the universe. He's a God who recognizes your debt of sin, paid for that through his son, and you can have eternal life as a free gift if you'll take it. That's what we're trying to get them to as a pastor.
They'd rather assign that design to aliens than somebody that they have to be accountable to.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
The alien's not going to care what sexual orientation you have in their mind or other kinds of things that people would rather be able to get away with. Right. I think that's absolutely right.
Have you appreciated his time and his insight tonight? Thank you so much.